Welcome back, everybody. Let's do a little review. What we were working on was the red one, and that was the pagan. And I felt the operative comment was, he was a pagan who runs alongside the Christian religion, meaning that Christianity was founded to bring paganism under control, psychologically speaking, so that has remained its shadow. And so it's a paganism that has been kind of boxed into its particular form 2,000 years ago, and now it's wanting to come back. The basic idea is always, at least up to now, and I'm learning along with you as well, this business of what I call spirit and matter, spirit and body, that these visions or these active imaginations are teaching him the point, driving home the point to him how, if he wants to spiritually evolve, he's got to accept his passions and the complications of living on earth, so that the spirit is no longer something separate, but something to be found in the middle of complicated living. So I would call that one of his main challenges here, to understand that. And of course then that became really a cornerstone of his work in alchemy, for example. And the next chapter where we stopped in the middle of was the castle in the forest. And he goes into a castle, sees a dry scholar with a lovely daughter. And in a way, you can see it's continuing what we had just been working on, where the young woman would personify his involvement in life and feeling and sexuality. He's realizing there's a difference between that and a life of dry scholarship. Why? I think we'll pursue this more today, but one, he's simply reorienting his definition of his professional self. I think he always wanted to be connected to university. And what he's seeing is what it does to people. It turns them into mental, boring, bored robots. I don't know if you have seen the movie Paris. I think you saw it, Kathy.
Yeah, I love that one.
It's kind of the same thing. It starts out with this professor at the Sorbonne, I think, who was teaching history, and a colleague comes up to him and is all excited about some picky uni little detail about a coin found, and it suggests that the Roman army was camped not on this bank of the river, but on this bank of the river. And this guy just says, "Oh my God, I can't believe this is what I'm turning into." And of course, then he meets a young woman, and complications ensue. Jung is working that out in his mind and realizing, I am very much interested in the life of the mind, but where am I going to live it out? Because if I go to the university, I'm going to be a vain, pedantic, old, crusty, boring guy. The other thing I think that he's working on is he's learning, or he's being taught, what a mind is. We've talked about this in Zarathustra, so you'll know this, Kathy, the rest of you may not. Our word mind has strayed so far from its original meaning. When we say mind in common speech, we mean like an intellectual processing machine. Originally, the mind meant the ability to perceive the spirit. You see that in the German word for mind, which is Geist, G-E-I-S-T, and spirit is G-E-I-S-T. They're the same word. So originally, the mind was thought of as an organ of understanding, and the intellect was just one part of that. But we have come to equate mind and intellect. So Jung is trying to discover then, what is the mind? How can I devote my life to understanding and not end up like a boring old professor? And what he's coming up with is going to be symbolic thinking. So that he's not only reorienting himself professionally, he's reorienting what he understands by understanding. And that is to be able to integrate knowledge with the emotions still attached. And to be able to see the continuity between knowledge and imagination. What we do in dream work is simply symbolic thinking, and that's what he's coming upon here, I think, when he realizes how much the scholar lacks. So that way of understanding isn't going to work. And realizing that it isn't going to work, he's coming up with another way of understanding. So I think that's what's going on. That all sound familiar? I think we left off at 263.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Could you then say he was dealing more with wisdom than knowledge?
Yeah. Or really not. It's knowing. Really not this, not calling knowledge that isn't connected to wisdom.
Say that last thing again. Not calling knowledge.
Knowledge, if it isn't connected to wisdom. In other words, the mind in, I think the subtext here is, the mind has gotten so abstract, which makes it a very powerful tool for science, but a very poor tool for understanding ourselves. It's good for understanding material processes, but it's not good for understanding living processes.
So would wisdom be bringing in Sophia and the feminine principle?
Yeah, the imagination, the feeling. What he's come up with through symbolic thinking, I feel, is a way of understanding that at the same time is mental and emotional, logos, eros, and includes the feminine and Sophia. And all of that being represented by the split between the old man and his daughter. And remember, the daughter says, I bring you greetings from Salome. So Salome was the first appearance of this wisdom, but in a very earthy form, almost too earthy. It's because he and I think the Western worldview was so mentally oriented, when the opposite, which would complement it, comes in in a storm of passion. And what he's realizing is he's got to accept the passion, but not identify with the passion, so that it can transform into feeling that will coexist with his thinking.
What would be another way of seeing not identified with the passion?
Well, that he, just because he feels something doesn't mean he has to go out and act on it. Or if he does act on it, act on it consciously. What's it mean to act on consciously? I think to ask yourself questions. Okay, this is what I'm doing. Now, what are the consequences of what I'm doing? What are the contradictions within what I'm doing? Is what I'm doing enhancing my life, or is it detracting from my life? Is it a step in the right direction for my life? Is it a detour? Is it a detour I'll get lost in? Is it a detour I need to take to get back to the main road? I mentioned to some of you that from the woman's point of view, that movie The Black Swan, it's playing. I don't want to ruin it for you, but she doesn't ask those questions if you see the movie. She just goes with a passion, and then you'll see how it ends. And if you are seized by such a passion, what Jung is, I guess I'd say learning, that for our time, somehow you've got to deal with it. And to let it find a place in your life, and at the same time, watch that it is not destructive. Because remember, Salome was a killer. And often the renewing passion and the destructive passion are in the same box. So, that takes us to the middle of first column on 263. And, again, some of this I'll go through very carefully, line by line, and some we can go a little faster over, but I think between now and one of the lowly, we'll go slow. As I was saying, if no outer adventure happens to you, then no inner adventure happens to you either. The part that you take over from the devil, joy that is, leads you into adventure. So he's saying, I can't just sit around and solve this in active imagination. Well, he didn't know what active imagination was exactly, although he was doing it. And why does he refer to the devil?
Because it represents joy.
Yeah, and that, I think, is what has been excluded in his life, probably also by his Protestant upbringing. So that what he has previously called the devil, he's having to go back and accept.
So it's like the devil is dancing. We don't smoke and we don't
choose. Exactly. I mean, it's not like a metaphysical term here. It's an adjective. What has been called devilish in my life, I've got to get back to and somehow come to grips with. And then that idea works itself through till the next paragraph. And look at the paragraph, my spirit, and go down 1, 2, 3, 4 lines. Everything ordinary in me suffered harm without my noticing it, and it began to hanker after life since I did not live it. So I think what he's realizing is, you know, he's become this successful doctor in the suburbs, and he's lost all his desires for simple pleasures, which so easily happens to the successful suburbanite. They're so busy wondering how they are seen that they forget to live. And since adventure, I was smitten by the romantic. Romantic is a step backward to reach the way one must sometimes also take a few steps back.
So like going back to recover what you lost at a specific point in your life, is that the step back?
Yeah, I think you could say that. Or, you know, judge by his current standards of respectability, stability, having fulfilled what one does, it looks like it's a step away from responsibility.
And the romantic he's talking about is his relationship with Tony.
I think what he's really doing is he's trying to get straight for himself why he has to have this affair.
Okay.
Yeah. That's my opinion anyway. And also, it's not just her, it's he's realizing through his attraction to her what the nature of passion is. And remember, for Freud, passion is an instinct. For Jung, it's a portal to the spirit. But you don't get the spirit until you've accepted the instinct, and that's what he's coming to terms with. I think, remember earlier I said accepting the passion consciously, you see that in his reference to the word way. The way. So, if you're, you know, if you are not conscious that there is a way to live, and you simply give yourself over to passion and it destroys your way, then it's been a very destructive experience. So to live it consciously is to say, okay, I know I want my life to go somewhere, and I also know I'm having this attraction, this experience, this feeling, this passion. How are these two going to fit together?
There's a book by Dennis Dutton called The Art, Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution, and it connects the instinct and the spiritual side of pleasure, because he feels that, he emphasizes art, but he feels that beauty and pleasure are evolutionary forces.
That's real close to Jung. That would be libido. And we live in a very erotically repressed society.
And he connects it with anything we take pleasure in.
Yeah.
Even you know, the beauty of nature.
A leaf.
Mm-hmm. So.
I think Freud would say all of that is based in an openness to erotic. If you can't be open to the erotic, you can't be open to the beauty of the leaf, because there are different levels of eros. I'm not sure Jung would go there, but certainly there's a connection. I wouldn't want to say it quite as black and white as Freud put it, but let's say maybe sensuality is one way we experience sensuality is in the beauty of nature. The other way we experience it is in the erotic. But it's this openness to being touched by pleasure or desire or elan, in the French, the energy to be active in the world, and so on. So I just wanted to make that clear, this business of, I thought so important, the way versus passion. And what he's trying to do is harmonize the two. I think as a rule, as a culture in America, much less Switzerland, We have sacrificed passion for the way.
And that way you're talking about is not the way like the Tao.
And that's not the Tao.
It's
that's
what's determined by the culture.
It's the way to live. It's the suburban ideal. And, you know, this idea of partying. People just go berserk. And it's so split from the everyday.
It's so repressed with all the repression.
Right.
Then when they party, whatever that word means. You know,
well, it's a big, drunken, sexual brawl. Unrelated.
It just explodes.
Yeah.
So it's not really passion.
Well, it's passion that's been stuffed away till it's hostile, really, to human relationship. And in a way, I think he's realizing, you know, that's the shape of my passion right now. That's why she first appears as Salome. Destructive. And now she's coming back in a more human form, but he's still wrestling with, how do I accept this and have it enhance my life, not just be one box that I go to now and then?
So is that, like in our society, it seems like there's either people who do all that,
yeah,
or there's the
right
politicians or the ministers who,
yeah,
are upstanding who don't admit
that they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he's trying to build a bridge so that these two worlds aren't separate. And that the passion doesn't come out in these either destructive affairs or behind the scenes manipulations or wild parties and so on. Okay, so you're with me so far. The last paragraph. In the adventure, I experienced what I had witnessed in the Mysterium. Mysterium, remember, is when he meets Salome and Elijah. What I saw there, Salome and Elijah became in life the old scholar and his pale, locked-up daughter. What I live is a distorted likeness of the Mysterium. Do you follow that? The Mysterium is, you might say, the unconscious image of his condition. And the, in other words, Salome and Elijah are the unconscious mythological images describing who he is. And behaviorally who he is, he's in danger of becoming an old scholar with a very pale soul, a very pale emotional life. Then skip a little bit. Last line, what I formerly loved, I must now experience as feeble and wasted. And what I formerly derided, I had to envy as towering and helplessly crave. I accepted the absurdity of this adventure. So what I formerly loved would be his nice house on the lake, his professional prestige. what I formerly derided, I had to envy as towering and helplessly crave. So he was looking down at people who were spending their nights in bars, walking the streets late at night looking for some fun. And now he's realizing that all has to change. No sooner had this happened than I also saw how the maiden transformed herself and signified an autonomous meaning. You see why he brings in the word meaning? Well, that if he's going to get to meaning, she holds the key to it. His feelings, his passions, his erotic interests are now also are not just an end to themselves, he's realizing they're also a means to an end. And that end is meaning. So we might say, the only way he can learn what he has to learn is to go through this experience. And he's realizing that. And that's who the girl symbolizes. And she's become more human from Salome because he's realizing the difference between the end and the means to the end.
Gary, that statement about that he was looking down at people who were walking the streets at night looking for fun.
Yeah.
Are you saying there that he was realizing or connecting with the fact that they were searching in this
absolutely
way, looking for meaning as well?
Absolutely.
Only
yeah
it was displaced in the earth. From his perspective,
yeah,
it was displaced in how they
were
going about
yeah
doing it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That,
okay,
you know, probably, yeah, you have to try to imagine Jung's house. It's probably, if not the biggest, one of the biggest houses in Zurich at the time. Think of your biggest McMansion in Carmel. And the social circle that would surround such a house and the way you'd have to behave to keep that social circle.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he married one of the richest women in Switzerland. Now, I don't think she was particularly a snob, but he was moving in that direction to be
above
Bob Irsay or somebody of Zurich. And all he had to do was march along, and he would have been at the hub of socialite living. And from that point of view, you look at these poor people in Broad Ripple crawling out of bars, and you think, well, what, boy, are they ever a bunch of losers. They haven't achieved what I've achieved. I think that's what's going through his mind. But then he's realizing, you know, who's better off here? These boring socialites are these people who are crawling out of bars at 2 in the morning. Because at least they're yearning for something, and they're not phony. And so he's realizing he's got to give up his perfect Ken Barbie life and start dealing with other stuff. And the only reason he would do that is because he's being pulled from within. There's nothing outside that would support doing that. Everything else I would say, Jung, you've got it made. What are you doing? If you want to have an affair, keep it quiet. But he's going through a fundamental shift in values. What is important? What's going to be important is eventually his creativity. But to get there, he's got to go through leaving being defined by his social position to experiencing another source of inspiration he doesn't yet have that source of inspiration. What he's got is a woman. Eventually, that will lead him to his inner muse.
Thank you. That's a major change.
Well, and particularly then, remember, because Zurich was still in the Victorian age, much more conservative than now, where the only thing that was important is how you appear, keeping up appearances.
And then he was being told that you're the person everybody wants to be. I mean, that, you know, he has everything that people are supposed to aspire to. So I would imagine there was a feeling of, how can I be so ungrateful?
And stupid.
Well, yeah, why did I want to...
Why don't I just be happy with what I got?
Some spiritual advisors might say, I don't know that I get this. You have to go and have an affair to get to this need. But some spiritual advisors might say, well, go on a retreat. I know that sounds dumb, but go in the desert or whatever and discern. That's a big word. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. Just put mulling this around in my mind.
Yeah, well, of course they would say that.
What's
wrong? They don't want to deal with the body. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I think now, remember, Jungian psychology didn't exist yet. Now, as often as not, I think the tools of Jung's work help people do just that. In other words, I think at times it is possible not to have to live it, but to experience it, work it through analytically, and so on. But there are also times when it has to be lived out, if the person's going to finish their lives.
Before Christmas, I was listening to a radio show where they were talking about Mary, and this minister was saying, you know, he said, his whole picture of that has changed, because he said, now that I've been in the delivery room with all three of my children, he said, this whole birthing thing, it's bloody, it's violent, and it's loud, and we've got this picture of this, you know, calm, silent night. And he's like, it couldn't have been, it not if she was a normal human being. And he said that there's, you know, when you get into the body and it's very visceral, it's just not pleasant. And he was talking about this piece of art that shows Mary in the way that he has now come to think of her, because instead of being all meek and mild, it's this young woman with a baby in one arm and like fist pumping the air, and her hair is wild and she looks like she's been sweating, and it's like, yes, you know, I did it. And it gave me some hope that maybe at least some segment of Christianity is coming around to that, you know, it's okay to be connected with the body, and that, in fact, that's what Christianity unique, is that we're supposed to believe that God values it enough to send, to experience it himself.
I think one way to put this, if you wanted to bring it to theology, is I always liked that statement of Pierre de Chardin, the Catholic priest, that we need a new definition of holiness. And I think what Jung is doing is redefining what's holy, and what is holy is the body as a vehicle for the spirit. I don't think it has to be in contradiction to Christianity. I think the way Christendom has interpreted Christianity, it generally is. But I don't think it has to be, and that's probably why a guy like Teilhard stayed in the church. Of course, his work was censored. He couldn't publish a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we could publish
his scientific writing.
Rock.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So you're getting this idea again. We're just coming back to the same idea, but on a different level, different imagery, different perspective, different references of the spiritual importance of physical material experiences. Then he gets into the feminine and the masculine in the next paragraph. Basically just withdrawing the projections of the masculine and the feminine. Anima and animus. But, as I always have to remind myself and others, before you can withdraw a projection, you have to make it. So, making it is what he would be doing by entering into this relationship. So, he's introducing the idea of the relationship between relationships and wholeness.
We don't actually make projections, though, do we? Or withdraw them? They come through from the self to draw us into learning something, and then it goes away when we have found the meaning of that.
Right, but I think the active part would be that we have to inquire about the meaning. Yeah.
You have to allow the feelings and then ask the question.
Why are they here? Again, same thing we've said. About the middle of the second column, if you take a piece of joy from the devil and set off on adventures with it, you accept your pleasure. But pleasure immediately attracts everything you desire. Now the business of consciousness, and then you must decide whether your pleasure spoils or enhances you. If you are of the devil, you will grope in blind desire after the manifold, and it will lead you astray. But if you remain with yourself as a man who is himself and not of the devil, then you will remember your humanity. How does this fit in with my entire life? You will not behave toward women per se as a man, but as a human being. Oh, I know something else I wanted to mention above, and he returns to it. How does he say that? Which says the ridiculous, remember in the first paragraph, and he uses the word absurd somewhere. I attempted the absurdity of this adventure. Now, I say that because he returns to that idea in that paragraph we were just talking about. But you must accept the ridiculous, otherwise you will suffer distress, and there will come a time when you are least observant. But it will suddenly round on you and make you ridiculous. You see why it's all that ridiculous, absurd.
What he feels, you know, with his high society sensibility, right? Because this is ridiculous.
Well, yeah, but I think it applies to any time you get socked with a strong affect that is pushing you to do something, it seems stupid. Why bother? It just seems absurd, but the absurdity has to be accepted so you can live until you get the meaning.
Here he's talking specifically about his accepting femininity.
Right.
By the man.
Right.
It seems to me like that, you know, that is something that has really played out in human behavior. He says, you know, to not behave towards the other as though they are of some opposite to you, but as to behave towards them as human beings. He says that here. You know, that's overcoming what we project on one another as masculine and feminine. And that's what I see people doing, you know, when they relate to one another, forgetting that I'm a woman, you're a man, but relating to one another as human beings.
I would just want to bring in the idea of absurdity here.
I guess I did change the subject a little bit.
Not really.
Well, he's talking about absurdity. I've got the idea that in his day, he's talking about how a man is looked at when he embraces those feminine elements within himself.
Yes, that's
and
one
that's
thing.
The absurdity, that specifically that he's speaking about at this moment. And then you're talking about how other absurdities...
Just how it feels absurd. You know, why should I bother following up mm-hmm. this friendship? She's married, or she's too young, or she's too old, if it's a man speaking. And to forget, to not forget, well, let's just have a friendship. It doesn't make sense, but just because it doesn't make sense doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. Because there's a sense to be realized later. I think that's what he's doing here. That's the absurdity.
I guess I saw the absurdity more in being willing to be unmanly.
Yeah, and to feel like an idiot and probably lose social stature in the process. Because remember when he split with Freud, he lost all his friends.
When he really runs the risk of losing his wife and his family and...
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of things that were very precious
mm-hmm.
to him.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you start down that path, you don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the consequences seem so great.
And you don't even know if something's going to happen.
No.
And that's the absurdity. Yeah. Not to not do it because it doesn't seem to make sense. Or you might say to do it, even though it doesn't seem to make sense.
That's why that segment in the film Paris is so perfect, because that character just is ridiculous. And he just allows himself that. And that one scene where he's dancing for her just
mm-hmm.
is hilarious if
yeah.
anybody gets to see it. But he gets in touch with this joy within himself.
Right.
The relationship, of course, ends
mm-hmm.
as it has to. But he's touched something.
Mm-hmm.
And it will change the kind of teacher he is and how he lives his life. And his relationship with his brother then changes after that. It's really a touching piece.
It's a lovely, lighthearted, but in a way very serious
mm-hmm.
treatment of hitting the wall, making a mistake. That would be the absurdity. Why did I have to do that, make a fool of myself in front of everyone else?
Mm-hmm.
Yet you get somewhere.
The name of it is Soul Paris.
Just Paris.
Just Paris.
Not Paris-Chatem.
No, not Paris.
Paris.
Just
Paris.
City. Paris. City. It takes place in Paris.
Yeah. The thing that's been kind of going through in my mind is, like, no wonder repression is so popular. I mean,
oh, yeah.
to go into that.
Yeah.
Because it's the consequences and the
right.
absurdity and the ridiculousness.
Right.
You know, the consequences.
Absolutely.
It's like, well... Does that fit in here, that's sort of like that surrender?
Right. Surrender to the absurdity.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think it was written yet, but after World War II, all the philosophy, certainly in France, existentialism, was about the absurd.
Mm-hmm.
Life is absurd. And that's how they tried to make sense out of the tragedy. And Jung certainly doesn't stop with absurdity, but he realizes part of it is doing things that just don't make sense. Simply because you feel like it.
But then asking the question, what is this leading me to?
And then doing a stereo recording, asking at the same time, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
but not doing it because you can't answer what's going on.
There's a great scene in that film too where he goes to a psychiatrist.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I don't want to ruin it. It's just, it's very, very good.
It's a recent movie or
what? It came out about 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay, so you can get it.
Has it been that long?
Maybe, yeah, 3 or 4
Could
years
be,
ago.
Yeah.
Juliette Binoche's in it, and this guy, this character, is one of my favorites. He's just a hilarious actor, very talented. Fabrice Luchini, I think is his name. I have a huge crush on him. He's very funny.
He is funny, and it's done with such humor. Only, you know, the French could, I think, like I said, I'm prejudiced, could do it with such tact, could treat a serious issue with such tact and humor.
There are many stories unfolding as you watch the film, and that's just one of the stories.
Subtitles?
Yes. We have to read.
Yeah. So what would Jung say to somebody who was going into the Vogue down the street in hopes of picking up a one-night stand because they just really wanted that? I mean, would that be...
Why not?
So he would say that would be okay.
Well, I think it probably depends how old you are.
Well, yeah.
If you're speaking to a 22-year-old, he'd say, you know, good luck. At 35, he might say, how long have you been doing this? Is it getting you where you want to go?
What are you looking for?
See, the trick is, or let me put it this way, the supposition of all of this is that the instincts are capable of regulating themselves. So, it's important in most circumstances. You certainly could bring up situations where you can contradict what I'm saying, but to not do anything that sounds judgmental. So even that, and might hit a judgmental nerve.
Instead of asking, what am I looking for, how about what's looking for me?
Well, that's nice, yeah. That's
and
nice.
Not a person, but what's the meaning of looking for me through this behavior.
So then, at those times when you meet somebody and there's this incredible chemistry and maybe they're not your normal type at all,
mm-hmm.
which makes the chemistry that much stronger.
Yeah, and more complicated.
Then what's really happening in the psyche is that something's looking for you, or
could be.
Does that person have something? I mean, I think that happens often when you're young, that you meet these people and say, oh, you know, and you know that you wouldn't want to make a life with them.
Yeah.
But it seems like he's saying there's such a powerful connection between the body and the psyche and
yes.
the spirit that there must be meaning to that.
Yes.
Beyond, you know, this really gets my blood racing. So that's what I'm trying to, what's the meaning? Or is that for you to figure out?
Each individual for each person. But there's something to be learned, which maybe can only be learned this way.
Well, what if you were British? You know, I mean, because they have, like, a theory, even this Myers-Briggs diagnosis for them, which because they're so repressive, maybe. And I just wonder how all this would change. I mean, it seems you'd have to work even harder to find, to follow your instincts.
You might,
I mean, because you were born in a country where...
Certainly, if you were raised in a small area, I don't think in any big city it would make a difference.
Yeah. Even a small, like, say, Indiana.
Yeah.
So, just a couple clarifying questions. You're going to go into your passion or into the thing that disturbs you that you don't want to go into, which would be different for each person, and different the spirit of the times versus the spirit of the depths would change over time.
Absolutely.
Would change from country, your particular self, but then your family and your country and your, and then, you know, all of those kind of things would change that. And then, what was my question? And then things like when you say instincts are capable of regulating themselves, but they don't always. For instance, addiction.
Well, if you, excluding addiction for the moment, if you, Jung's feeling is, if you know how to maintain the right attitude toward the instinct, it will, in time, with caring attention from consciousness, take you somewhere, and it will change. Now, I think addictions, that has been so, in an addiction, that has been, that truth has been so maligned by upbringing that the instinct is out of control. But that's a consequence, not a condition.
You're saying that the addiction is a consequence, not...
Yeah, the fact that the instincts are so out of control in an addiction is because they've been messed with seriously. And you really got to mess with them for a long time to get them that out of control. That you, what I'm saying doesn't apply anymore. It does once you have gotten control of them with willpower, which is what AA is about. Then I think you can go back to this. But, right, in that case, it's a different situation in an addiction.
And we have the dreams, too, to help us.
Yeah, when...
You know, with Jung's work,
right,
we know how to work with the dream.
Right.
To lead us.
And that's what I meant by the instincts will legislate themselves through the imagery they create. If you understand it, you are given the tool for helping them change. That they actually want to change with your help.
So could we include synchronicity in those images?
Yeah.
Visions, dreams,
yeah.
Synchronicity.
Absolutely. I don't know if I told you this story or not, the preacher and the almost affair. Apropos these things finding you, when I first moved here, I was seeing a young preacher who he was just supercharged with the erotic. And I wouldn't say he was unhappily married. They have two kids, I think. But he was just oozing affair. And next sentence, change of scene. I was at a party, and I met a woman who also, I thought, this, she's married, but this woman is looking for an affair. Well, guess what? The two met. See what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, what were the chances of that? And he did not have an affair, but he accepted that he wanted to have an affair. And we worked on it. And he then entered a program of pastoral counseling. Got a degree in pastoral counseling, and he's since moved away, but set himself up as a pastoral counselor. As far as I know, still making his living in that way. But in that time, after he decided, with some serious struggle not to have a physical affair, this woman and he remained friends. His wife got pregnant. They wanted to have a third child, so they had a third child. And she got depressed. And so she came in to see me. Her dream was that he was having an affair. He was having an affair with his new interest. Had he not accepted his unhappiness and his longing for more, which showed up sexually, he wouldn't have got to the meaning of that yearning. He really wasn't yearning for an affair with a woman. He was yearning for an affair with a new professional interest.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way these things appear. But the fact that those two met is hit me as an illustration of what you said. In a way, you could say fate brought them together. And something was looking for him. It was a new professional interest, and the way it met him was in the guise of a woman.
Which is interesting because counseling is a more feminine kind of occupation. You know, ministers telling people what to do, authoritarian and masculine, where a counselor is listening and and nurturing through. So.
Do you have a stretch?